This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. He joins us every Thursday in the 12 o'clock hour. Rafi, welcome to the show.
Great to be back, Neil. A lot to talk about.
Absolutely. The much-awaited report by Teneo, Bill Bratton, on New Orleans major event reviews and security recommendations is out. And a lot of folks have been able to consume it. I read it last night. Your thoughts?
Well, I was impressed with the overall document. Many people just focus on the fact that this report is going to make a recommendation about whether Bourbon Street should be a permanent pedestrian mall. But this report goes well beyond that. But, you know, with respect to the pedestrian mall aspect of it, their recommendation is that it be made a full-time pedestrian mall. And I don't know if the public really supports that particular measure. In this, I attended two of the three meetings that were held in the French Quarter, and the general sentiment, the people that live and work and operate businesses down there, was that they didn't support a full-time pedestrian mall down there. So with increased security comes increased inconvenience. There's always going to be trade-offs. Even if it were made a full-time pedestrian mall, there would still be threats that would be assessed there. There would be vulnerabilities on Bourbon Street with respect to bombs and active shooters and things like that. So there's always going to be some trade-offs in that. And, you know, this report also says that, you know, much of the French Quarter is in the same boat as Bourbon Street, where there are threats with vehicle ramming attacks that could be launched not just on Bourbon Street, but other parts of the French Quarter. The group that was commissioned to do this, the Bratton Group, formerly known as their official name is the Teneo Group, they were present in town for the planning leading up to the Super Bowl and Mardi Gras, and, you know, they observe all of those. And many of their recommendations weren't just based on what occurred on January the 1st on Bourbon Street, but their, you know, on the streets, observations during special events, the highlighted special events in this city, which were the Super Bowl and Mardi Gras. So they were able to assess the police department and the city's ability to provide a safe and secure environment for those type of special events. And as we all know, is there special events every weekend in the city of New Orleans. They may not be the scope every week of the Super Bowl or Mardi Gras, but they are. You know, literally, you can't go a week without some type of special event. We're a tourist destination. A lot of conventions come into town. And when they come into town, they just don't go to Bourbon Street. They visit a lot of our other aspects, other things that we offer as a community. So this report, I think, really pointed out some, I think, important measures that go beyond just the visible should Bourbon Street be a pedestrian mall. They identified some weaknesses within the police department, saying that there was inadequate interagency coordination. So the Teneo officials, you know, were able to sit in on the planning sessions for Mardi Gras and the Super Bowl. And they commented that they believe that that process should be more structured, more formalized. And it was termed as being ad hoc, meaning that certain officers were dealing with their counterparts in other agencies. And if one of those parties from the other agency leaves or the NOPD officer leaves, there is, you know, a vacuum created. There needs to be a written, structured policy in place as to how the NOPD is going to interact and interface with all of their partners so that there is not any potential weakness if someone is sick or leaves the employment of the police department. They also talked about the inadequate number of barricades and barriers available to the city. They pointed out that some of the barricades that the city had had inadequate crash ratings. So the police department and the city are renting and leasing some barricades while they're deciding what type of barricades to purchase. And this report talked about some of the issues that they observed with that. So, for instance, during Mardi Gras, many of the barricades, or at least a percentage of the barricades, were held in reserve. And the Teneo group said that those barricades should be deployed. There shouldn't be any held in reserve. They should be all deployed on the streets because, you know, we, quite frankly, they say that we have not only inadequate numbers of barricades, but, you know, the barricades that we're using don't have the crash ratings that would be optimal to protect crowds from vehicles that were going to try and ram them. They talked about creating a community vigilance campaign. If you see something, say something. That's something that, you know, is done in other parts of the country. We aren't doing that here, and they recommend, and that's another one of their recommendations, that New Orleans should deploy before every major event and get the community aware of their role. If they observe something, how they can quickly, you know, report any suspicious activity or objects to law enforcement. They also noted the fact that for parade deployment, officers were bunched together in many parts of the parade route. They recommended spacing the officers out more so that there would be more coverage and more visibility along the entire parade route. So those are just, you know, some little things, but those are, you know, important. It shows to me, you know, how thorough and observant they were in what they were looking at. They talked about the fact that New Orleans has an insufficient explosive detection unit and capabilities, and they need to be able to identify chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and explosives. They talked about the fact that technology needs to be purchased for the New Orleans Police Department. They talked about some explosive canines, bomb-detecting canines that should be available to the police department that they currently don't have or don't have in sufficient numbers. They noted the fact that there are a number of trash bins along the parade route that probably should be moved, you know, during Mardi Gras because of the ability of people to put explosives based on experience with other explosive devices placed in trash bins in other parts of the country during terrorist attacks. They noted the fact that the NOPD, even though they have a drone unit, didn't deploy any drones during Mardi Gras, and the reason the department didn't deploy their drones was because the officers that operate the drones were used for crowd control along the parade routes. Now, that was compensated for, in part, by the Louisiana State Police that were present that had their drones available, and the fact that the city of New Orleans had a SEER 1 designation, so Homeland Security also deployed drones in the air, but the NOPD drones weren't available because of staffing deficiencies. And those staffing deficiencies not only impacted the deployment of drones, but other creating other potential vulnerabilities along parade routes and with the police department's ability to adequately provide for security for other special events. So we've, you know, been talking about that for years. The fact that, you know, the department's numbers, in fact, last week we talked about how recruiting hasn't been going very well for the New Orleans Police Department, that we're losing more officers than we're hiring. And that not only impacts the department's ability to adequately staff special events, but day-to-day operations of the police department in every area. So Taneo identified that as a vulnerability and a weakness of the police department. They also suggested that SEER 1 designation be maintained for Mardi Gras going forward, because that provides federal resources that would otherwise be unavailable, and particularly with the staffing deficiencies and equipment deficiencies that the city of New Orleans has right now, that SEER 1 designation would mean that federal assets would be available for Mardi Gras, which would be beneficial to the city. So they're recommending that going forward, that the SEER 1 designation be actively sought and secured by the city of New Orleans. They recommend technology upgrades. So they noted that there really needed to be a fixed incident command post established for special events, including Mardi Gras. And they noted the fact that there is technology out there called the National Incident Management System that is used by law enforcement, you know, around the country. We don't have that technology right now, and they recommend that the city of New Orleans purchase that. They also recommended tabletop exercises in preparation for special events. Superintendent Kirkpatrick had a press conference yesterday announcing that the police department was conducting a tabletop exercise. So they're already implementing the recommendations of the Taneo group, and they conducted a tabletop exercise in preparation for the French Quarter Festival that starts today. So some of the recommendations are already being accepted. Others are under review. It talked about one of the, I think, most important things that most people are not going to be aware of is the NOPD really lacks adequate intelligence analytical capabilities. Right now, they rely on the State Police Fusion Center. Jefferson Parish has a fusion center. Did you create that fusion center, Newell?
When you were there? Yeah, the Criminal Intelligence Center, yeah.
Yep. So New Orleans doesn't have one. They rely on the state police, and I think at times they participate in the Jefferson Parish Center. Is that correct?
Yeah, we actually had 17 agencies when I left that were involved in that intelligence center, and it served two purposes. One, just the accumulation and dissemination of criminal intelligence out on the streets throughout the metro area. We developed strategies in dealing with that, as well as whether or not there were any terrorist threats in coordination with the State Fusion Center that was run by the Louisiana State Police, which I think is pared down in size. It was housed at LSU back then, and I don't think it's as robust as it once was.
All right. So, you know, what they're saying is that a city like New Orleans that has the special events that we have in light of what had happened on January the 1st, there, you know, NOPD has an analytics division, but they currently lack the ability to proactively assess threats, synthesize intelligence, and support investigative efforts. So increasing the capabilities to include those areas of the analytics division is something that Teneo pointed out is not a want, but it's a need for the NOPD. Now, to do that, you know, you have manpower restrictions, you have budgetary restrictions, but that is not a luxury, that's a necessity. If you're going to adequately protect the city and its visitors, I think we need a more robust analytics division that can also handle threat assessments, and our current capabilities do not include that.
The whole impetus, Rafi, for trying to create this coordinated and collaborative unit that we set aside. Actually, we gave office space, computers, and everything to all the participants, because I recognize the importance of collecting this data. New Orleans data was important to JP. JP data was important to New Orleans because crime knows no geographic boundary, and the intelligence information that you're gathering out there crosses all of the jurisdictional lines. The willingness of a lot of agencies to continue to participate because of the lack of human capital kind of waned, and they kind of fell off the map. But you know, the infrastructure, I'm assuming it's still there. I'm assuming it's still alive and well. That's the type of thing that needs to be done. I don't think any singular agency has the assets or resources necessary to do it on their own. It's not cheap. You know, and it requires a lot of communication. And the thought process that I had is that if we could co-locate people at a location, you develop relationships, you know, trust in one another. You're sharing information real time. It's not ending up in the bowels of some agency somewhere waiting to go through some chain of command, because you never know when something that may not seem extraordinarily relevant turns out to be real relevant in real time because something's happening that actually embraces this piece of intelligence information that you have. And you want to be in a position to be able to do something with it.
Well, exactly. So, you know, we've been talking about the fact that crime has been decreasing in the city, and it's in large part because of the police department is engaging in proactive policing, and so are their partners. I would say that intelligence gathering and dissemination and assessing threats, that is critically important in proactive policing, because if you wait for a bomb to go off or an incident to occur, that means that you're playing catch up. If you can identify it before it happens, then it makes the community safer. So even though there is a staffing shortage, I think that this is critically and maybe even more important to have this in-house capability, and maybe the way that this be structured for the time being is for the NOPD to more closely partner with the Jefferson Parish Fusion Center in this and tie all that into the state center. But, you know, I don't think that this is a luxury. It's a necessity. And I think it's critically important tool to law enforcement in proactive policing and getting in front of some of the threats that exist rather than responding to them after they occur.
And I think just to put backdrop to this, the listening audience has a better understanding of the context. A lot of what Teneo is recommending is what is done in New York City. And when we first started with what was called urban area security initiatives under the Department of Homeland Security, we actually had that designation down here. Now, they prioritize these what were referred to as UOSIs as it relates to threat assessments. And threat assessments at that time were basically critical infrastructure, rail, ports, certain types of buildings, hospitals, things of that nature. The big cities ended up being favorably treated, more so than a third-tier city like the city of New Orleans, in spite of, you know, Mardi Gras, the fact that we were, putting on Super Bowls, major conventions, major fairs and festivals that a lot of the cities had, but not really to the size that we had. But we never really got to that top tier. So a lot of what they're talked about was actually financed by the federal government for the city of New York. And this, and not to say that the city of New York didn't contribute, because they did. They took it very seriously. All of this equipment that you see them mention in this report, I've seen how they deploy it operationally in New York. I was very curious, went up there, spent several days up there, saw the storage facilities that they had, the deployment equipment that they had. They took this stuff serious, and they had the necessary. There was never a doubt as to who was going to move barriers. Somebody had that task. Somebody had access to the equipment. They were trained on the equipment. And when the order went out, we're deploying this, 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 and this in zone whatever, done.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, seamless. But, you know, it takes a certain amount of human capital, takes a certain amount of money to do so, and a leadership commitment to do as much. I don't know that we've ever had that leadership commitment over the last 20 years to really engage in this exercise. In fact, I feel very confident in saying we did not, because we did very little in that regard, contrary to all the training that we all receive. I mean, I know a lot of those NOPD leaders went to the same training that I went, and the question really was, were you going to come home and actually do something about it or not? NIMS has been around for 3 decades, if not more. I mean, you know,
so what's happening right now?
Not a new revelation. What's that?
No, that's all very informative of that, because I've never been up to New York to see that. And I know that there's a cost in that. So in New Orleans right now, the barricades that are deployed in the Bourbon Street area, they're deployed by NOPD officers. So those barricade deployments have to be put down in the evening and picked up in the early morning. And it takes about an hour and a half of an officer's time. And that is, in my opinion, a misuse of our police force. That shouldn't be the responsibility of police officers to deploy that equipment. That should be other city, you know, workers that go do that, because it's essentially manual labor. I think
in New York, it's civilian personnel under the NYPD, if my memory serves me correct. It's been a while since I've been there, but I think they were civilian personnel under the NYPD.
Well, we need to have something like that in place. So this plan provides a blueprint from where we are to where we need to aspire to be and how we can move in that direction. And I think that it's already been acted upon in some respects. We're waiting to see what the mayor is ultimately going to decide, because the superintendent has already said that it's going to be the city's decision about whether to make Bourbon Street a mall, which is code for saying it's up to the mayor to decide if Bourbon Street is going to be a permanent pedestrian mall. That remains to be seen. So we'll be looking for what the decision is in the near future from the mayor's office with respect to that recommendation.
All right, we got to get to a break. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of Metropolitan Crime Commission. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, in my review of the security recommendations made by Teneo, there was one area I thought I would see, but I didn't, is they never really brought any of their recommendations back to the fact that carrying a concealed weapon within the confines of the French Quarter is routine now, and how to best police that happenstance.
So that issue was brought up at some of the community meetings that I attended with Teneo, and their response to that was, that's a political decision that is needs to be made at the state level. So I think that was a polite way of saying that they didn't want to wade into that swamp in that. But that's, you know, active shooters, I believe, pose the greatest threat to safety in the French Quarter and at special events, much greater than vehicle ramming attacks. So that's the elephant in the room that hasn't been identified and addressed yet. So after January the 1st, when the National Guard was deployed there and they were inspecting people's bags, they, you know, if they wanted to go on Bourbon Street, they had to submit to a search. And the guardsmen could open, you know, require someone to open their bag or pouch or backpack. And they were just looking for bombs. If there wasn't a bomb in there and they saw a bag full of firearms, they waved them through and told them to have a nice day. So that poses the greatest threat, as far as I'm concerned, firearms. But that's state law that allows that to happen. And unless and until that state law is recognizes that the French Quarter and particularly the Bourbon Street area, which is essentially one big open bar, because people can walk up and down the street, you know, with to-go cups, and you can't bring a gun into a bar, but you can bring the bar out to the street, and that's where people are walking, and that's where the greatest threat from a safety perspective lies. And you're right, that report didn't address that issue for the reasons that I described.
Yeah, I was just looking for something, observations operationally, how to best deal with that. The other day I had City Council Member Leslie Harris on, and we talked about the fact that the DNA backlog had pretty much all been eliminated at this point in time, which is quite the accomplishment and great news for the city of New Orleans.
Well, yeah, but let me give you a little background on that. So, you know, this backlog is because the current crime lab has not achieved accreditation for conducting DNA analysis. So this crime lab that was opened about 2 years ago was destroyed during Hurricane Katrina. So it took from 2025 to 2023 to open the crime lab. And right now what the crime lab is doing is drug testing and firearms and ballistic analysis and fingerprint analysis, but not DNA. So when this building was designed, before the Cantrell administration, it was designed and did not include DNA labs in it. So here we are, you know, we're going to build a crime lab and not have in-house DNA capabilities. When that was discovered during the Cantrell administration, you know, they did a quick redesign of those plans. And what I'm telling you today is that the DNA labs that are constructed right now in place, and what the new crime lab director is doing, is attempting to hire the staff, get all the machines calibrated, and get their accreditation, and they hope to be able to do DNA testing in-house beginning sometime in 2027. But right now, the head of the DNA lab, Dr. Kelly, is concerned with the layout of the current DNA facilities. And they've engaged an architect to come in and see what it would cost to reconfigure the DNA labs that are inadequate or substandard to what is needed to conduct DNA analysis. On top of that, the building right now that was just opened 2 years ago has a mold problem in certain parts of the lab. So they're in the process of trying to identify with the construction process what went wrong and, you know, why there are, you know, a mold issue in certain rooms and certain floors of the facility. So, you know, what we're talking about, what Leslie Harris was talking about, is, you know, the DNA component, taking a look at all of the backlog of DNA kits from
reported getting that matters.
Yeah. Right. So those were based, since we didn't have in-house capabilities, we're relying on the Louisiana State Police Crime Lab. They don't have the capabilities to keep up with their workload, much less the workload of the city of New Orleans. So as a result, the backlog of DNA rape kits from New Orleans had to be outsourced to out-of-state crime labs to help work their way through that. And they've largely done that. But it took $4 million, $3 million from the city of New Orleans and about $1.2 million from the state of Louisiana to get largely caught up. But now we're using out-of-state firms, which means that if there is evidence that's going to be used in a criminal prosecution, the city of New Orleans has to fund the travel of experts that will come to court to testify. So if this was housed in the New Orleans Police Department, you know, they could literally walk from their building to criminal court. It's right behind criminal court. And that information and those experts are available with no additional cost. But we're, in addition to paying these private out-of-state firms, if that evidence is actually used in a case, those experts, you know, have to be flown in, which costs additional money. So this is, you know, an important capability. And unfortunately, DNA was not included in the initial plans, and in the plans that were actually completed and built out, the DNA capabilities and the configuration of the offices and labs are inadequate right now, and the city is trying to determine how much it's going to cost to, you know, address and rectify some of those deficiencies, which maybe makes the anticipated opening date for DNA capabilities of 2027 somewhat optimistic, depending on what is ultimately decided and what type of changes need to be performed.
Unbelievable. We'll be right back. Rafael Goyeneche, President of Metropolitan Crime Commission. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We're visiting with Rafael Goyeneche, president of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. Rafi, let's pivot to quarter one crime stats.
Right. So, you know, we get to finish on a positive note, you know, because we just released those. And what we're seeing is with respect to violent crime incidents, which includes murder, attempted murder, armed robbery and non-fatal shootings. Those rates are down 59% from the first quarter of 2023 to the first quarter of 2025. If you compare the first quarter of 24 to 25, we're still seeing a substantial decline where we had a total of 170 violent reported offenses in the first quarter of 2024 versus 140 in 2025. So part of the reason for that decline is the department has engaged in proactive policing. Every one of those offenders that commits a crime now are more likely to be arrested. And as crime goes down, even though we're still suffering from inadequate staffing, if there are fewer reported crime incidents, that means the police can respond quicker. And there are fewer calls for those officers to be deployed to, which means that they can spend more time on active current investigations rather than just responding from one call for service to the next. With respect to automobile thefts, I know over the years we've spoken about how auto thefts exploded in the city of New Orleans in 2023. And we've seen a 248% decrease in auto thefts between the first quarter of 23 and the first quarter of 2025. So that's a positive step. And what that means, and what that suggests, is the police department is doing a better job in identifying the people that are committing those automobile thefts. They've arrested more of them. You have a finite number of people that are stealing cars. And as they get arrested, not only are they being held accountable for the car that they had stolen, but they're also being, prevented from committing future automobile thefts. So those are positive steps and trends that we're seeing from the police department. Just imagine if they had additional resources, including, the DNA capabilities to identify more of the violent and repeat offenders, and the touch DNA capabilities from recovered stolen cars to identify more of the individuals that were responsible for stealing those cars. So, when we get those type of capabilities, I think that the police department can be even more successful than they've been over the past 2 years in reducing crime in this community.
Yeah, that's absolutely great news. You know, it's interesting. I mean, if you had a full-fledged crime lab, full-fledged DNA lab, and all of those other support services that every department, every major department in this country has access to for the most part, who knows where these numbers would be? I mean, you'd be able to, solve more crimes, get more of the impact players off the street, and that's what drives crimes down, better prosecutions. I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling when you think of what they've been able to achieve with not a whole lot of support.
Exactly. So I think that there is, a real groundswell of support from the community and from the political leaders. We're going into a mayoral election session, and one of the foundational pieces of any political campaign is public safety. And I believe that, it's going to be, something that we hear a lot about during the upcoming, campaigns of the next mayor, how they're going to prioritize crime and what resources they're going to be able to deploy to assist the police department in further reducing crime going forward.
Yeah, and unfortunately, with the most recent BGR report, I don't know if you reviewed that, about this inability of the city to be able to account for their finances, their expenses, and otherwise, they get shocked by a $42 million, I think, deficit in the police operating budget, an overspend over here as well. Now we're finding out from the roads program that we could be $700 million, $800 million short. And you look at the Teneo report, I mean, there's a lot of dollars that are going to have to be associated with accomplishing a lot of what they're recommending if we want to take this seriously. I'm not confident that the leadership is going to be able to find this, because that means that they're going to have to cut other things that are their kind of favored pet projects. And that's going to be interesting. I don't see it happening.
Yeah, I mean, we do have limited resources. It's going to have to all fit together, but I have to, believe, and maybe I'm being Pollyanna, but I believe that the public is demanding that public safety be a priority going forward, and that hopefully that's reflected in the campaigns of the candidates for mayor and the next mayor.
Hope springs eternal. Thank you so much, Rafi Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. Have a great weekend. See you next week.
You too. Take care.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We'll check in with Ian Hoke, who's in for Scoot. Ian Hoke's in for Scoot. What do we have coming up, Ian?
Good afternoon, Sheriff. We're going to talk with Zach Lemon from the Insectarium about buckmoth caterpillars. They're coming, man.
There you go.
We'll talk about where we are in the world of AI. And I want to ask the audience, when was the last time you experienced the sublime?
All righty. He's up next, Ian, that is. Stay tuned. We'll see you again in the morning.